you call it. Well, he used this following image. He said, it's as if the person comes into therapy, and there are two people that come in. One is the nurse, and one is the child. And the nurse brings the child into the room. And the nurse sits and amiably chats with the doctor. The nurse would be, in my language, a self-care assistant. Amiably chats with the doctor, and meanwhile, the child goes off in the corner and starts to entertain itself. And he says, this can go on for a long, long time. And the nurse explains why the person is there and so on and so forth, but doesn't necessarily talk about the little one. And that the therapy only really begins when that child enters the relationship and starts to play. Will get us through hell and high water, and it helps us survive this world, so we must be very careful to honor it. These archaic and tyrannical structures need to be retired with full benefits. Because they're a miraculous part of the way the psyche saves the human soul for regrowth later. The only problem is they get stuck, and the regrowth later doesn't happen. You know, there's not a second stage. So that tends to be the way it works, and that's the way I understand so much of the way the psyche organizes and tries to prevent disorganization. Okay, now let's get up for a quick stretch and limber up a little bit, and then we're going to quickly do another fairy tale. Here's a poem by Rilke which captures what we've been talking about. No one lives his life. The skies since childhood haphazardly assembled from voices and fears and little pleasures. We come of age as masks. Our true face never speaks. Somewhere there must be storehouses where all these lives are laid away, like suits of armor, or old carriages, or clothes hanging limply on the walls. Maybe all paths lead there, to the repository of unlived things. And yet, though we strain against the deadening grip of daily necessity, I sense there is this mystery. All life is being lived. Who is living it then? Is it the things themselves, or something waiting inside them, like an unplayed melody in a flute? Is it the winds blowing over the waters? Is it the branches that signal to each other? Is it flowers interweaving their fragrances, or streets as they wind through time? Is it the animals warmly moving, or the birds that suddenly rise up? Who lives it then? God, are you the one who is living my life? This is Rilke's, again, the provenance is unknown to me. The book was actually in the bookstore can't remember the collection, but it's, I think it's The Book of Hours. Yes, thank you. The Book of Hours by Collection of Rilke's poetry. That gets to the point that several people have made. Would you please, they said to me, clarify whether or not you're saying that these spiritual experiences are only possible if you're traumatized? Actually, nobody actually asked that. But what they kindly informed me, and I understand this, was that I was implying that somehow people with a trauma history have a privileged access to these spiritual dimensions, and maybe they do. But I certainly wasn't intending to convey that that trauma is the only way that we get broken open to this deeper substrate in the personality at all. I didn't mean to imply that. It's always there. We open to it in all kinds of ways, and we're visited by it in all kinds of circumstances, not necessarily traumatic ones. I think oftentimes we get a glimpse of it simply when we are still, when we are in solitude, when we listen, when we are still, and when we attend to the ground of our being instead of the figure of our frantic existence, which is where we spend so much of our time. And all of us will spend so much of our time this afternoon rushing along the nation's eastern highways to get home. So we do need to take time to attend so that this deep ground where the soul lives can reveal itself. Now, we have roughly 40 minutes left, and I'm prepared to take you rapidly through our next fairy tale, if you would like. Okay. Then let's do that. We will see as we go many parallels to our existing tale. This is called The Water of Life, and let's look at the basic structure of this tale, first of all. We have a sick king to start with. We have somewhere in the far distance a castle. A castle which is bewitched. A spell is cast over this castle. Princes and princesses inside the castle are under this spell. And this spell-cast castle contains what are known as the water of life. It contains a wellspring of the water of life. Now, clearly, the tension in the tale is how are we going to get from this ill king and his condition to a condition of healing, and the water of life has to be brought to the king some way or another. The other thing that we realize is that one of the figures that's bewitched or under spell in the castle where the water of life is a princess. You might think of her as the lost soul of the king. So let's talk a little bit about the king who has an illness that no one believes he could come out of with his life. What does it mean when we say, when we start a fairy tale, that the king is ill? Well, as we mentioned yesterday, the king is often the prevailing attitude of consciousness. It's the authority of consciousness. It's the existing dominant assumptions of the ego personality, the executive personality that's in charge of the life of the person. This king is ill. So, translation, this person, if we can take this fairy tale, is about a fictitious person, is depressed. Okay, the idea of an ill or wounded king and the wasteland that surrounds him is in the Grail legend. You know, the Enfortis wound, the king, the wasteland. The king can't die, the king can't live, nothing can live, everything is drying up, the waters are not flowing, the plants are dying, there's pestilence in the land. So this is the state of an ego structure that has lost its source of vitality and life from within. And that is the operational definition of depression. Something's been cut off. So the three sons of this king, who are, after all, the future, what do they do about this? They go down into the garden and weep. Now, we've seen how crucial that is in our fairy tales. They go down into the garden and weep. And an old man comes to them and inquires about their grief. Now, we know when this happens, fairy tales, that this this old man is not just an ordinary old man. This old man is the beginning of the healing process, because the weeping is the beginning, is the attitude of the ego that's necessary to restore the connection to the lost soul. Water flows, tears flow. These three sons are at their wits' end, they're grieving potential loss of the father. They tell the old man that their father is ill and that he most certainly will die, for nothing seems to cure him. And the old man says, I know of one remedy, and that is the water of life. If he drinks it, he will become well again, but it is very hard to find. So, the eldest son, now usually in fairy tales, the eldest sons are closest to the king's attitude about how to solve the problem. The younger you go in the lineage, the closer you are to the unconscious. And frequently in fairy tales, it's the little dumbling, or it's the awkward, bumbling third son that rides out on the ass instead of on a horse, backwards, who finds the golden apples or whatever. And Marie-Louise von Franz, a Jungian commentator on fairy tales, says this is emblematic of what Jung means by the inferior function. The inferior function, is always, Jung has this quadrated understanding that we have a dominant type, introversion or extroversion, but then we have thinking, feeling, sensation, and intuition. Those are the four functions that orient our consciousness. And the idea is that we have dominant function and auxiliary function and subsidiary function, but then there's one of those functions that's always sort of where our shadow is. And where our shadow is likely to be also where the solution to our problem on the ego level is going to have to be found. So she says the third son represents the inferior function. I find that a little bit self-serving in terms of Jungian thought. I don't think fairy tales are talking necessarily about the functions of consciousness, but nonetheless, you get the point. It's a reasonable point. So the first son, representing the dominant attitude, says, well, I'll go out and get the water of life. Just think, if I go and get the water of life, the king will give me the kingdom. So, here's a division of minds, right? Part of him is weeping in the courtyard. Part of him wants to heal the king. But the other part of him is interested in self-aggrandizement. He wants to get the kingdom. He wants to ingratiate himself with the king. So he rides out, and guess who he finds on the path? But a shrunken little dwarf. Yes. And he says, the dwarf asks him, where are you going in all this haste? And he says, ah, you silly shrimp, get out of my way. And rides away. Well, the dwarf gets angry and causes him to have a huge problem. He rides into a very narrow valley that gets narrower and narrower and narrower until the mountains close in on him and he can't turn around on his horse. So he's wedged between a rock and a hard place. Which is a perfect cure for his ambivalence. Right? So that's the plight of the first son. The second son has the same experience. He rides out, he meets the dwarf, he has the same contemptuous reaction to the dwarf. And he rides into the same fix. He's also wedged between the mountains. And so he can't do anything. So the third son pleads with the king. The king is desperate now because he sees, all of his sons. Neither of the other two have come back, and now the third one is threatening to leave. But finally, he consents to allow the third son to ride out. When he meets the dwarf, and the dwarf asks him whither he's going in such haste, he stops and gives a full explanation. He says, I'm seeking the water of life for my father, who is sick unto death. Do you know then where that is to be found? As you have borne yourself, says the dwarf, in such a seemly way, and not haughtily and hastily like your false brothers, I will give you the information. and I will tell you how to obtain the water of life." So the dwarf here shows himself to be another representation of the old man that presented himself in the courtyard. In other words, the transpersonal control point is starting to influence the course of this tale, and it's almost like a guiding function. It's helping to bring about the reintegration of these parts that were split. And that's what Jung meant by the individuation urge in the psyche. That there's an integrative agency in us that wants us to heal, wants us to be whole. And that if we relate to it in the proper way, it will help us. That's the basic message. Whereas if we rampage through, our stories trying to enhance our egos, what we think is the solution, oftentimes we don't get help from this side. So the dwarf continues, "This water of life springs from a fountain in the courtyard of an enchanted castle. But you will not be able to make your way to it if I do not give you an iron wand and two small loaves of bread. With the iron wand, strike 3 times on the iron door of the castle and it will spring open. Inside you will find 2 lions with gaping jaws. But if you throw a loaf of bread to each of them, they will be quieted." These lions apparently like pastries. But that's all right. I mean, we have to give a certain amount of creative license to the writer. Then he says, "Hasten to fetch some of the water of life before the clock strikes 12. Otherwise, the door will shut and you will be imprisoned." So the prince thanked him, took the wand and bread, and set out on his way. When he arrived at the castle, everything was just as the dwarf had predicted. He knocks 3 times, the castle door opens. The lions roar, he throws them each a loaf of bread. He's allowed into the hidden chambers. And there sit enchanted princes with rings on their fingers. He takes off the rings, which I think is an image of de-enchanting them or liberating them from bewitchment, because they're bound to this by rings to this enchanted world. And he enters then a chamber. Well, first of all, he finds a sword and another loaf of bread are lying there in the enchanted chamber, which he carries away with him. And after this, he enters a chamber in which is a beautiful maiden, who rejoices when she sees him, kisses him, and tells him that he has set her free, and he should have her whole kingdom if he will only return in 1 year when their wedding will be celebrated. So he doesn't have her yet. He has to go through a testing period of 1 year. Likewise, she tells him where the spring of the water of life is, and he has to hasten and draw it before the clock strikes 12. So he goes onwards, enters the room where there happens to be a very beautifully newly made bed, and he's very tired. So he lies down for a little slumber. Now, this is an interesting interlude in the fairy tale. Instead of going about his task, he takes a little nap along the way, feeling rather satisfied with himself, and he lies down. Well, he wakes up just before 12 and suddenly realizes where he is and what's happening. He rushes to get the water of life, gets a cup of it, and just barely makes it out of the door, and the gate swinging shut cleaves off a part of his heel, but he makes his way out. Now that's an interesting little piece of the fairy tale. You all remember Achilles' heel? And you know how Achilles got his heel? He was dipped in the vat of immortality, held by the heel by, I can't remember which goddess. Was it Demeter? Whoever held him, it doesn't matter. The point is, this is the only place of humanity, you see, in Achilles. In other words, it's the only place where he can be really hurt, where he can be injured. So his invulnerability and his immortality are rendered vulnerable at that place. Well, the young son, apparently, you know, in his sort of complacency and self-satisfaction, lying down slumbering on the way, has his heel lopped off. So he's now a wounded healer. He's now a wounded hero. So he starts home, and he starts back, and as he's going homeward, he passes the dwarf again. And the dwarf sees him and says, "Oh, you have this lost sword and this loaf. With these you have won great wealth, my son. With the sword you can slay whole armies, and the bed will never come to an end." And the prince takes this all in, thinks, "Wow, that's really neat." He says, "But I don't want to go home until I find my brothers." And now this is very interesting. These are the two brothers that, you know, have this ego orientation. And the dwarf says, "They're imprisoned between two mountains, and I can tell you where they are, but I've condemned them to stay there because they are so haughty." The prince begged until the dwarf finally released them, but the dwarf warned him, "Beware of them, for they have bad hearts." But you see, the third son's attitude is one, this is one of the defining characteristics, is one of wholeness. He doesn't want to proceed without his other two brothers. And he's totally guileless and concerned about the badness of their hearts. He's not going to split them off because they're bad. He's not going to make them bad. He wants them with him. Now, they cause a lot of trouble, as you can see, but he wants them along on the journey. So they ride together, and now the healing energies of this third son are already starting to have effect, because they come to three kingdoms along the way, which are depressed and depleted, where there's starvation and loss of energy. And in each case, the young son is very generous with his sword and his loaf of bread, and he loans them to the king, because the sword is a magical sword and will slay all the enemies of the king, and the bread is like the loaves and fishes that will feed the multitude. So the bread brings great plenitude to each of these kingdoms. So you can see that already he's not employing the water of life yet for the old king, but his healing energies and his healing attitudes, generosity, guilelessness, and openness and wholeness, are already having effect. So they make their way further towards home. They take a sea journey, and while they're on the sea, the two brothers with bad hearts start to plot against the enemy. And they decide to substitute seawater for the water of life. So they steal the water of life from them, keep it to themselves, put seawater in the cup where it was, and they make their way home. Well, when they get home, the third son is very excited. He comes to the king, says, "I found the water of life," and gives his dear father the seawater, which makes him extremely ill. At this point, the elder brothers, with their stolen water of life, come to the father and say, "Our younger son was trying to kill you, father. We have the true water of life. Drink this and you'll be well." He does, and he is well. So the king naturally thinks, "Oh my God, my son was trying to kill me. The third son was trying to kill me." So we have this terrible point in the fairy tale where he decides he has to kill the third son. Now we know from later on in the story that he does this with great grief, but because he's very fond of his third son. But nonetheless, he's been convinced that the third son has tried to kill him. So the other two have sworn the third son to secrecy on pain of death. So he banishes the third son, sends him out with the huntsman, the woodsman, and says, "Shoot him." Well, here we have a similar situation to some of the tales that I told you about, where the huntsman or the woodsman can't do this. The third son is too good and too righteous and is fond of him, so he takes him out into the woods, and there's this scene where the where he confesses what the king has told him, and the third son is shocked. And he says, "But I can't do it." And the third son, "Well, give me your clothes, and I will disguise myself, and I will go deeper into the forest," which he does. So this is the sort of second exile. This is the trial now of that part of the psyche that has the connection to the soul, but the old order, the old mind, if you will, the old king and two elder sons have conspired to re-repress this new attitude and banish it into the forest. Well, then, as the tale unfolds, the three kings whose depleted kingdoms the third son has saved on his way by giving the bread and the sword begin to send gifts of gratitude to the father, who's now restored to health. And these gifts start to come in, and the king begins to wonder, "Oh my God, these are gifts that honor my third son's generosity and beneficence. Maybe he was innocent after that. Maybe I have had the very person who saved me, the very source of my redemption and healing. Maybe I've repressed this completely. Maybe I've had it cured." So he's in deep grief, and he says, I can't remember whether it's the huntsman at that point. Let me see here. Yes, after a time, three wagons of gold and precious stones came to the king for his youngest son, which were sent by all three kings who had slain their enemies with the prince's sword and maintained their people in his bread. The old king then thought, "My son must have been innocent," and said to his people, "Would that he were still alive. How it grieves me that I have suffered him to be killed." And then the huntsman comes to him and says, "He still lives, Your Honor. I could not find it in my heart to carry out your command." And he tells the king how it happened. And then the same language is in our previous tale. A stone falls from the king's heart. And he had it proclaimed in every country that his son might return and be taken into favor. So you can see here that even though the king was carrying out this death sentence for his innocent young son, it grieved him, and he was divided about it, and a stone was on his heart because he had done it. So the news that this young son is alive takes a stone from his heart. Now, meanwhile, the princess, remember the princess? who has been under this enchantment and freed now by the third son, has a road made up to her palace, which is bright and golden, and she tells her people that whoever comes riding straight along this road will be the right one for her. And the eldest sons, who have still not been punished for their misdeeds and still think that they are going to get the kingdom and the princess, ride off to get the princess prematurely, and each of them are so afraid to ride on this gold road because they think they might break part of it off, and after all, they're interested in wealth, and this is an extremely wealthy road. They ride on the side of it. In both cases, they reach the palace, and the young princess says, "Well, obviously, you're not the one. You haven't ridden on my golden road." The third son rides out. He doesn't even see the road because he's so completely absorbed. A year has passed now. He's so completely absorbed in finding his love and restoring his connection to this lost soul. So he rides right up to the palace on top of the golden road. And the princess immediately receives him with joy, says that he is her savior, lord of the kingdom. Their wedding is celebrated with great rejoicing. Now the wedding is When it was over, she told him that his father invited him to come to him. She now conveys the fact that the father has reaccepted him. He rides thither and tells the father everything, how his brothers had betrayed him, how he had nevertheless kept silence. The old king wished to punish them, but they had put to sea and never came back as long as they lived. Now, we might think of those two elder brothers as the kind of defense system. They slowly recede into oblivion as the story, as the central issue, which is the restored connection to the soul, between the soul and the ego, is cemented. They become less and less necessary. You don't have to punish them. This isn't exactly retirement with benefits, but they put to sea, and they're never heard from again. They just aren't necessary anymore. Now, in looking at this tale, there are several things we should talk about. One is, what is this water of life? This is a mysterious healing substance. The alchemists talked about aqua mercurialis, which was Jung talks about it as a kind of liquid version of the self. It's philosophical water. It's spiritual water. It's not just ordinary water. And I'm sure many of you remember the passage in the Gospel of John where Jesus encounters the Samaritan woman at the well and says to her, "Whosoever drinketh of the water that I shall give him shall never thirst. The water that I give him shall be in him a well of water springing up into everlasting life." So Christ image here is recognizing this miraculous quality to this spiritual water. Water is always associated with life, of course. And Christ said that I have come that people may have life and have it more abundantly. So it's symbolic of that life-giving substance which is associated with the soul, which is where the princess is. And it's only a reconnection to that soul life that brings healing to the lost king who has lost his meaning and lost the center of his own vital existence. There's several other things we can probably talk about. The attitude of the third son is important. You notice he is not plagued with ambivalence. His heart is set on healing his father. He doesn't do this out of an ego place. He's not like the eldest two brothers representing the old mind attitude. And as I've said before, he's unconcerned about the badness in people. He can include them in his return journey. He's identified with wholeness. And this turns out to be what eventually allows him to find his way back to the princess, you see. This story gives us a glimpse of how important the forces of evil are in our own individuation process. The way the people that have bad hearts are teachers for us, if we will allow them to be. And the story says that unless you include some of that darkness in your selfhood, in your understanding of who you are, unless you can admit it, admit the darkness in your own heart, you can't get to the soul. Just like in the previous story of the handless maiden, the evil one, if you really look at the story as a whole, the evil one who cements the bargain with the woodcutter, with the miller, and takes the child, chops off her, has her hands chopped off at his behest, and sets her upon this whole journey, returns at the end, and if it weren't for that evil one giving the bad messages, the second stage in her suffering would never occur. The whole story would have ended at the silver hand stage. So we have here the paradoxical role that evil plays in our stories to take us deeper into our own pathos and suffering, and ultimately to release us. That's one of the real ironies, and one of the, I think, very telling indicators that we have to include the darkness in our wholeness. We have to allow the shadow side of ourselves a place at the table. Otherwise, we can't complete our stories. And in both of these stories, neither of these stories would be completed. The second stage would never have occurred if the bad-hearted sons hadn't been included in the return journey and in the early fairy tale, if the devil hadn't come back to scramble the messages that required eventually that the handless maiden to retire into, to be exiled once again, and to grow out of the silver hand stage in her solitude in the forest. Well, there's a great deal more about this tale that we could talk about. The role of enchantment, that altered state that the princess is in, is something that we find, I think, in all of our lives, but in people with a trauma history, that encapsulated part of the psyche. The defensive system seems to operate in two ways. One is to encapsulate the lost, innocent part of the self, to hold it in a castle or a fortress. And the second way, because it needs to preserve it, that's the preservation part, protector part of the defensive system. And then it cuts that part off from access to the ego. That's the second one, and that's the persecutory negative energy. So encapsulation to preserve the good self states, the lost heart of the self, and then cutting off or walling off. And that's why I think you find oftentimes that part of the whole self is under a spell or in an altered state, unavailable to consciousness, asleep, or benumbed. Psychic numbing is something that's been talked about a lot in terms of Robert J. Lipton's work on traumatic experience and corruption. So, that's not a complete rundown, but at least it, I think, gives you an overview of this fairy tale. Yes, that golden road, it's the Via Regia, isn't it? The royal road that Freud said was the dream was the Via Regia into the unconscious. The golden road, that road of truth that the soul needs to find its way out on. See, because she has to ride out on that golden road with him who is ridden in. And I think there again, we could say that the elder sons who have the old mind of the sick king can only see that gold in terms of their avarice and greed, whereas the younger son holds the gold of his love for this princess and his commitment to his journey, completing his journey, and doesn't even see the wealth or the materialistic dimension of that road. He completely overlooks it and rides in as the one who. Yes. Yeah, well, this is the problem, isn't it? You see, there's a parallel between the way men are brought up and the negative attitudes in the patriarchal defensive system that gets established that hates weakness. So, we have to have the courage of our own tears That is so clearly a message of these tales, that every time we need the courage of our own grief, the courage of our own tears. That's what Helen Luke meant when, if we can cry, we get penetrated. The weight on us ceases to become the issue, and we bleed, we cry, we can open up, we can be penetrated. And I think that that is the critical variable in every one of these tales. Fairy tales have a clear message. If you want to heal the splits in yourself, you have to have the courage of your own grief. And it's extremely difficult to go there for all of us. But it's life-saving. Judith? I will repeat it. Judith said that this is a matter of the heart, that so clearly we have to drop out of our heads and into our hearts, and that is so clearly at this stage in our situation with the environment, a dropping into the darkness, the feminine, and that right now, because of our head egos, dashing on in haste and only being able to see the materialistic realities, we are poisoning the waters of life on the planet. And this, of course, is true. And so all of our efforts to save the waters of life on our planet are part of our own individuation task at this time in history. And I know something that you all think very strongly about. Now, in ending, we are going to have to end here. I would like to express my gratitude to you for this experience. These dialogues that we've had have been very important to me. And I was telling various people privately, but I'll say to you publicly now, I don't know what I think or how I feel until I say it. And I have heard myself say things over the last couple of days that I've been happy about, and that have pleased me, and that I didn't know I knew. And that only happens in a dialogue with others who are open and available and relatively non-judgmental and are participating in the search for truth. So I've had that experience with you, and I want to express my gratitude for it, and thank you for inviting me, and thank you for your comments and your participation.